How's your car looking? Showing its age? Faded paint? Dents? Dings? Don't worry. Maaco is here to help. They're the experts in affordable paint jobs and light collision repairs, helping you keep your car looking its best without breaking the bank. With Maaco's national reach and community focus, you're not just getting top-notch service. You're actually getting a partner you can trust. Visit your local Maaco today and see how they can refresh your ride. Go in, get the free estimate, and the expert technicians will handle the rest. Uh-oh, better get Maaco.
I've never felt like this before. It's like you just get me. I feel like my true self with you. Does that sound crazy? And it doesn't hurt that you're gorgeous. Okay, that's it. I'm taking you home with me. I mean, you can't find shoes this good just anywhere. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at your DSW store or DSW.com.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.
This is continuing coverage of the case against Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
If you were hoping for a heartbroken widow panicking in the chaos of her husband's sudden death, you surely didn't get that on the morning of July 11th, 2019. What you got instead, according to prosecutors, was Lori Vallow Daybell ordering a breakfast combo at Burger King while her husband, Charles Vallow, lay shot and dying on the floor of their home. Yeah, breakfast combo, hubby dying. I'm not making that up. That's not internet rumor. That's what prosecutors say. The surveillance footage, cell phone tracking, and receipts proved down to the minute. Lori Vallow Daybell, the trial, part two, day number six, is what we are breaking down for you right here. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you are watching this. If it's on YouTube, be sure to comment as well. Give us your thoughts on the events of the day. And if you're listening to the podcast, hey, press subscribe there too so you don't miss any of our coverage. If you want to go comment on it, please check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. You'll find it. And you can join in the conversation there. And of course, vice versa. You can listen to the podcast. You can watch the podcast wherever you are. Press subscribe in both places. We do greatly appreciate that. So at 7:54 a.m., just minutes after the state believes Charles was fatally shot, Lori was in red in her red SUV, pulling through the drive-thru with her son, JJ, in the back seat. She didn't call 911. She didn't ask for help. She got food. She dropped JJ off at school, and then she drove to Walgreens to buy two pairs of flip-flops. All of this before the first emergency calls actually came in. At 8:36 a.m. from her brother, Alex Cox, the man who pulled the trigger. The gap between the killing and the call, roughly 42 minutes. Self-defense, 42 minutes to call 911. Wonder why that was. Now, just pause and think for a moment about that. If your spouse had been shot dead in your living room, whether it was an accident, self-defense, or even something you didn't witness, would your next stop be to a Burger King drive-thru? Would your first instinct be, better grab sandals and get the kids to school? That's the contrast that had the jury leaning forward in their seats during day six of Lori's Arizona murder trial, because the evidence wasn't just strange, it was cold. Detective Ariel Werther from Chandler Police took the stand and broke it all down using Charles' cell phone, location data, and surveillance footage. From the various places Lori stopped, investigators were able to piece together a timeline that frankly doesn't paint her in a great light. Is there anything that really paints her in a great light, though? It turns out Charles' phone, which Lori allegedly took with her, was moving away from the scene before the 911 call was even made. That alone is a bombshell. According to Detective Werther, either Lori left the house long before anyone bothered to call for help, or the shooting happened significantly earlier than she or her brother claimed. Either way, it's a serious problem for Lori Vallow Daybell and her being her own defense. The prosecution laid it out clean. Lori wasn't acting like someone caught in a tragic accident. She was acting like someone following a plan. If this had been a chaotic moment, or a sudden act of violence that no one expected, you'd expect panic, confusion, maybe even hysteria. But Lori, she had to go buy some flip-flops. Let's talk about the Walgreens stop for a second. Video showed her walking in calmly, making her purchase. No signs of distress. Not calling anyone. Not acting like someone whose husband had just died violently. She and her teenage daughter, Tylee, was with her too. According to the police testimony, neither of them looked flustered. It's as if they were just running errands. Normal morning stuff. Except this wasn't normal morning. And that's exactly the prosecutor's point. They also introduced a Burger King receipt into evidence, time-stamped, itemized, clear as day. Lori made the stop to have it her way, ordered food, and didn't so much as reach for a phone to alert anyone about what had just happened back at the house. It wasn't until nearly 8:40 that Alex Cox decided to call 911 and report the shooting. By that time, Lori had dropped off her son, handled her shopping, and taken her sweet time getting back to the scene. Burger King, flip-flops, drop the kids off. You know, like you do when your spouse is murdered in your house that morning. Even more chillingly, by 2:18 that same afternoon, Lori was already calling a funeral home. That detail might have gotten lost in the noise if the rest of the actions hadn't already raised so many eyebrows, but taken together, it paints a picture of someone moving quickly, not to grieve, not to process, but to wrap things up. Businesslike, very detached. All of this added fuel to the fire the prosecution's been stoking since the beginning, that Charles' death wasn't a spontaneous act of self-defense, but a planned-out event that Lori helped orchestrate and then managed with eerie composure. They are not just saying she was involved. They're saying she had a motive, a plan, and a post-murder routine. And that routine is what got so much attention in court on April 15th, because it wasn't just what Lori did, it was how she did it. Calm. In control. Like it was any other Thursday morning. And that behavior didn't go unnoticed. Another Chandler detective, Cassandra Yenklan, also testified that Lori's demeanor on the day of the shooting struck her as off. Too calm, too lighthearted, not what you'd expect from someone whose spouse had just been shot to death in her house that she shared with her kids. Detective Inklan gave Lori and Tylee a ride to the police station after the shooting. During that car ride, Lori was, as Inklan put it, just kind of chattering. No sobs, no shock, just small talk. At one point, when the detective attempted to formally inform Lori that Charles had died, a procedure known as death notification, Lori cut her off. I already know. She said, I was there. Didn't think that went through, did you, Lori? Now again, not illegal, but definitely not typical, and that's been a running theme throughout this trial. So much of the state's case is circumstantial. There's no security footage of Lori pulling a trigger, no smoking gun text message, at least as far as we know yet, saying, let's kill him tomorrow. But what they do have is behavior, timelines, choices, movements. And when you look at those movements, flipping through a Walgreens aisle, calmly ordering food, running the school drop-off like any other day, it adds up to something hard to ignore. Let's be clear. The defense hasn't denied that Lori ran these errands. The timestamps are real. The video footage is real. What they might argue is that Lori was in shock, that she was processing things in her own way. It's a valid point to raise, but the prosecution is banking on the jury not buying it. They're arguing that this wasn't shock, it was calculation. One particularly damning piece of the puzzle was that what Detective Werther said about Charles' phone, because Lori had taken it. She returned it to officers later that day, but by then investigators had already pulled GPS data from it, and that data told a story. Not just of where the phone went, but when and where. The when was the damning part. So that's what we got here. A man shot dead in his home, a 42-minute delay before anyone calls for help, a trip to Burger King, a Walgreens stop, a school drop-off, a funeral home call that afternoon. Not just one red flag, that's a whole parade of red flags. The prosecution knows that jurors didn't need a full confession to convict. They just needed to believe that Lori wasn't reacting to a crisis. She was managing one. She wasn't scrambling to save a life. She was making sure her plan stayed on track. And that brings us to the uncomfortable takeaway from the day six of the Lori Vallow Daybell trial. When faced with the brutal sudden death of her husband, Lori Daybell didn't scream, didn't cry, didn't run. She drove, she shopped, she fed her kid, and she didn't dial 911, not once. Which leaves us with the question that'll hang in the air as the trial continues. Was Lori Vallow Daybell a bystander to this tragedy, or the project manager of a murder? It's one thing to be confident. It's another to be completely out of your depth while everyone in the room watches you slowly sink. And that's exactly what played out in the courtroom as Lori tried and repeatedly failed to play the role of her own attorney. This wasn't a bold legal strategy. It was more like watching someone walk a tightrope in flip-flops, blindfolded, while insisting they knew exactly what they were doing. The jury saw it close up when Lori took the floor to cross-examine Detective Ariel Weather, the same detective who had just walked the court through Lori's morning of breakfast runs and shopping sprees after Charles was killed. Instead of challenging the evidence or poking holes in the timeline, Lori veered straight into irrelevant territory. Surprise! She began asking about Charles' romantic life. Did the detective know who Charles had been texting? Was he seeing anyone else? Did he have a scheduled phone date with another woman? The prosecution was having none of it. Trina Kay objected almost immediately, pointing out that Charles' dating history had nothing to do with the matter at hand, his death. Judge Justin Versky sustained the objection, looking visibly irritated. He told Lori in no uncertain terms, whether he went on dates or had dates scheduled is not relevant to this case. Ask another question. But he said it really nicely and patient. Lori tried to push back, insisting that it was somehow important, but the judge cut her off. It wasn't. It wasn't just that her questions were off topic. It was the way she delivered them. Lori kept inserting herself into the questioning, saying things like, I understand. It seems to me. Which judges don't appreciate, especially when coming from a defendant who's acting as their own attorney. In court, you're either saying questions or testifying. You can't do both at once. And Lori has been blurring those lines since this started. Judge Bursky had to remind her again, don't make statements, just ask your questions. But the questions kept coming, and they kept missing the mark. At one point, Lori asked Detective Werther if he was aware that Charles had sent someone $1,000. No follow-up, no explanation of why it mattered, just the implication that Charles was doing something shady by sending someone $1,000. No context. The witness didn't know where she was going with it, and honestly, no one else did either. If her goal was to redirect suspicion or cast doubt, it didn't land. Instead, it came across like she was trying to embarrass the victim in front of the jury. The kind of move rarely plays well in a courtroom, especially when the victim can't defend himself. But Lori, well, she wasn't finished. She turned her attention next to Detective Cassandra Inclan, the officer who had driven her and Tylee to the police station the day Charles was killed. Again, instead of addressing any legal inconsistencies or highlighting procedural flaws, Lori went on another tangent. She asked if the detective knew she had been barefoot when she left the house that morning. Inclan said no. Lori followed up with a comment about Arizona pavement being hot in July, explaining that's why she later bought flip-flops. It was almost surreal. She continued by asking the detective whether she was aware that people in stressful situations can get very thirsty. The inclination or the implication there? That's why she stopped at Burger King after the shooting. Not because she was hungry or casual or detached, but because she was thirsty under stress. Oh, poor Lori. Poor Lori effing Daybell. The detective gave a polite but bewildered response. Yes, stress can cause thirst. But the courtroom clearly understood what was happening here. Lori wasn't defending herself. She was trying to justify things that, when stacked together, looked incredibly damning. Unless you're Lori Vallow-Daybell and a malignant narcissist, that you can only see things from your perspective and your narrative is going to trump everybody. The problem was she wasn't building a legal argument. She was offering personal excuses. And that's not the same thing. Judge Bursky gave her some latitude, enough to make her point, but when Lori began talking about fight or flight mode and how stress affects human behavior, the prosecution objected again. The judge sustained it. This wasn't a psychological seminar, and Lori wasn't a doctor. It was a murder trial, and these explanations weren't doing her any favors. But perhaps the most legally dangerous moment came when Lori, maybe unknowingly, wandered close to a very bright red line, bringing up her prior trial. During her questioning of Detective Inclan, Lori started asking about whether the detective had seen media coverage of her. Had she read about Lori's other cases? Did she watch any interviews? Trina Kay immediately objected. The judge called a sidebar. It's not clear what was said at that moment. Sidebars aren't public. But what we do know is that when the court resumed, Lori dropped the line of questioning entirely. Reporters in the room suggested Judge Bursky may have warned her not to open the door. If she kept pushing that topic, the prosecution could be allowed to bring up her previous conviction in Idaho, the one where she was found guilty of murdering her two children, JJ and Tylee. That information has not been formally introduced into the Arizona trial yet. And if it is, that could be catastrophic for Lori's defense. Oh, but don't be surprised if somehow it gets in here. The judge, I think, can only give so many roadblocks and so many, hey, let's pull the brakes back. You sure about this? At some point, she's her own defense and she can sink her own damn ship. Let her. I say stop the guardrails. Let her sink her own damn ship. What do you think? Tell me in the comments. In that moment, Lori might have realized just how dangerous it is to play lawyer without a license. Or not. That wasn't the only procedural headache that she faced. At one point earlier in the trial, she told the court that she couldn't open a flash drive of cell phone data provided by the prosecution. It didn't work with her team system. That sparked a whole technical back and forth in court. Now, to be fair, that's the kind of hiccup that can happen in any trial. But when it's the defendant herself raising the issue because she's running her own legal team, it's not a good look. It made her seem unprepared, and that perception matters. From beginning to end, Lori's self-representation didn't resemble a legal defense so much as a series of emotional reactions. When faced with strong evidence from the state, GPS data, surveillance video, police timelines, she didn't counter it with facts. She tried to counter it with personal antidotes, flip-flops, thirst, have it your way, chicken fries, dating drama. But those aren't legal arguments. They're distractions. And the jury did seem to know it. Every objection that the prosecution raised, and there were many, were sustained. Each time Lori veered off into Charles' personal life for some half-baked theory about her stress levels, the judge had to reel her back in. And that pattern over and over again created a rhythm in the courtroom that was hard to ignore. The state was focused. Lori was flailing. By the end of the day, it was hard not to see the contrast. On one side, prosecutors building a narrative with timestamps, evidence, and structured testimony. On the other side, Lori Vallow Daybell asking if people get thirsty when they're stressed. It wasn't just ineffective. It was revealing. Because what Lori did in that courtroom in front of the jury mirrored what she allegedly did after Charles was killed. She managed the situation, not with urgency or clarity, but with a kind of strange detachment. And whether it was wandering Walgreens for flip-flops or wandering into courtroom rabbit holes, the pattern felt familiar. But all this does raise a deeper question, one the prosecution still has to answer. For all of Lori's missteps, for every weird moment, every bad argument, there's still a central issue the state has to confront. Did she actually conspire to kill Charles? Did she help plan it? Or did she just act strangely after the fact? By the time the courtroom lights flickered off on day six, the prosecution had painted a pretty vivid picture of Lori Vallow Daybell. Calm after her husband's shooting. Oddly detached. Running errands like it was just another day on the calendar. And then, acting as her own lawyer. Launching into bizarre courtroom antics that left the judge sighing and the jury squinting sideways. But no matter how strange or suspicious Lori's behavior may look, there's still something the prosecution hasn't handed to the jury. A clear, concrete line between Lori and the act of murder. There's no smoking gun, no wiretap, no text message that reads, "Let's kill Charles tomorrow." At least not yet. No one stood up and said, "I heard her say she wanted him dead." And that absence, no matter how overwhelming the circumstantial case might seem, does matter. Because without that, what the state has built so far is interference. Strong interference, maybe, but still interference. And when you're talking about proving a conspiracy to commit murder beyond a reasonable doubt, interference alone can make for shaky ground. Start with the man who pulled the trigger, Alex Cox. He's dead. He died in December of 2019, months after Charles Vallow was shot. He's been described by investigators as Lori's enforcer, the one who took care of things. He was the person who made the 911 call that morning and told police he acted in self-defense. He was there. But now he can't answer questions. He can't be cross-examined. He can't say whether he was just reacting in the moment or following instructions. That void has left the courtroom with a lot of assumptions and no first-hand account. And Alex wasn't just any co-conspirator. If the prosecution's theory is right, he was the muscle. He was the one who acted while Lori pulled the strings. But that is the issue. If the prosecution's theory is right, without Alex, the jury can't hear from the one person who might have confirmed or denied that a plan ever existed in the first place. So whether everything about Lori's role is being built from the outside in, it's body language, it's errand running, it's her tone, it's what she didn't do, it's what she didn't say, it's what came after, not what happened before. Now add that to the fact that at the time of the shooting, nobody was treating this as a homicide, not even the police. Charles Vallow's death was originally handled like a classic domestic self-defense case. That's a whole other topic to criticize the police on. The brother-in-law said there was an argument. Things escalated. Shots were fired, and that was it. No one arrested. No one arrested Lori. No one charged Alex. There wasn't a manhunt or even a suspicion, at least not officially, that Lori was questioned like a witness, not a suspect. In fact, the same detective who testified about Lori's behavior in the car, Detective Inkland, admitted that they weren't aware of the time gap between the shooting and the 911 call until much later. That 42-minute delay didn't even raise flags in the beginning. Here's where it gets tricky. The prosecution is now asking the jury to believe that what looked like a justified killing was actually a calculated execution planned by a woman who never physically pulled the trigger. And they're asking them to believe this without a direct witness or piece of evidence that lays it all out, at least not yet. Instead, they're building the case around Lori's alleged motives. And there are two big ones they're leaning on, money and Chad Daybell. Let's start with the cash. Charles Vallow had a life insurance policy worth $1 million, and Lori, at least at one point, was a beneficiary. Prosecutors played a call in court where Lori is heard talking to the insurance company, sounding stunned that Charles had changed the beneficiary just months before his death. She didn't get the money. It went to Charles' sister, Kay Woodcock. But according to the state, Lori didn't know that when the plan was set in motion. She believed she'd be getting $1 million payout, and that, prosecutors argue, was enough of a motive. That's a compelling theory, but that's exactly what it is, a theory. Yes, she made a call. Yes, she seemed surprised. But there's a gap between assuming she wanted the money and proving she orchestrated a murder to get it. And the defense could easily argue that the motive falls apart when she realized Lori ended up with nothing. No payout, no windfall, just a dead husband and a lot of questions. Which leads us to the motive number two, Chad. Chad Daybell, dreamy Chad. At the time Charles died, Lori had already started spiraling deeper into her relationship with Chad, not just romantically, but ideologically. Together, they believed, or claimed to believe, in a fringe version of LDS theology that included zombies, past lives, and the idea that certain people were possessed by dark spirits. Lori allegedly believed Charles was one of those people, that his soul had been overtaken by a dark entity named Ned. Ned. She said he was no longer Charles. He was a shell, a danger, a thing to be eliminated. It's chilling stuff. And in some ways more terrifying than the life insurance theory. But again, we're back to the world of belief, not fact. The prosecution has to be careful here because it's one thing to show that Lori held strange religious views. It's another proof that those beliefs translated into a criminal conspiracy. They can quote texts, bring friends who say she talked about zombies, but unless those messages explicitly say, "Let's kill Charles," it remains circumstantial. Creepy, sure, but not a confession. And that's the hole the defense will likely try to drive a truck through. No, it's Lori, so we'll see. Maybe more like a mini scooter or something. Or one of the things you just stand on and it rolls about, like the mall cop, Segways. A Segway. I could see Lori doing a Segway. That'll say Lori's behavior was odd, but not illegal. They'll argue that people grieve in weird ways, that Lori's running errands wasn't part of the plan. It was her processing trauma. That's her courtroom theatrics weren't manipulative, that they, it was just Lori being Lori. But the thing is, Lori has to argue that herself. She may argue that there's an absence of clear, direct order or witness statements that creates doubt, reasonable doubt. If she's smart, she'll argue that. But that's the standard here. It's not weird beyond a reasonable doubt. It's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury doesn't have to like Lori. They don't have to even believe her. But if they can't say for certain that she helped plan Charles' death, they can't convict her for conspiracy. And right now what's missing from the case are the moments that tie everything together. There's no one saying Lori handed Alex a gun. No text saying, "It's time." No phone call laying out the plan. There's a A lot of strange behavior, a lot of unsettling ideology. But what the prosecution still needs to do is pull all of those threads into something tight enough to hold under scrutiny. Because when you strip away the receipts, the surveillance, and the quirky courtroom comments, you're left with a fundamental question. Did Lori Vallow Daybell help plan the murder of her husband? Or did she just behave horribly in the aftermath? As the prosecution nears the end of this case, that's the tension still hanging in the air. The state has built a strong narrative, but the narratives aren't enough. They need evidence, direct evidence. And as of day six, there's still one thing this trial hasn't delivered. That. Think they got it? I'm going to guess they have something a little bit more up their sleeve. Maybe there are the text messages. Maybe there aren't something. We'll find out. Give me your thoughts in the comments. If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to press subscribe as well so you don't miss our coverage of this case. If you're listening on the podcast platform, press subscribe there too. Check us out on YouTube. Leave some comments. Be sure to, again, like I said, press subscribe because we're bringing you the audio of the trial every single day on our YouTube channel. So if you want to listen to the courtroom drama every day, we got that for you there. And of course, we'll be continuing to give you these daily updates that break everything down as the trial proceeds. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you guys for listening. And yes, please get in those comments. Let me know what you think.
The latest true crime stories, expert breakdowns, and shocking twists all in one place. Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.